Blog Talk Radio.
Jeanettes. This was the first ruling family of England, and they started in France. That's where the origin of these people. Joffrey in 1113 conquered Normandy, and that was the launching base for William the Conqueror to go and cross the Channel to attack Harold at Hastings and defeat him and start the first English house called the Plantagenets. They were the Richard, the Lionhearted, Henry, several of them, and then it was Richard the Third, and then it was the Tudors, which gave us Henry the Eighth and Elizabeth the First. The guy in England who was also connected with the Methodists, William Wilberforce, was born, and he was an anti-slavery advocate, and he successfully, along with others, got England to be the first country in the world to ban the African slave trade. In 1816, a guy named Daniel Gooch laid the first Atlantic cables. And the Atlantic cables are very interesting because it's quite a job to lay those cables across under the ocean. And, of course, during World War One, William Stevenson, who worked with MI5, the British Secret Service, was alleged to have tapped into the Atlantic cables to read the cables from the communications from the Kaiser's government to the German embassy and the German operatives in the United States before World War One. And then, of course, the famed Liberty ships in 1886, William Francis Gibbs was born. And he's the guy that designed the first Liberty ships, which, again, saved England, transported all of the material, food, gas, gasoline, military material, and then later men over to England to fight World War One, and also to keep England in the fight against Hitler. Among the deaths today, in 1998, E.G. Marshall died at 88. Now, he was the guy who was born in Minnesota, and he never revealed what E and G stood for. But if you remember the 60s a law program called The Defenders, he starred in it. Also, he was his first movie act debut was in a film about Chicago police corruption called 997. It starred James Stewart and has a connection to my speech teacher, the late and great Dolly Farnstrom, who taught speech to me at Wilbur College, and also to Tim Novak, who was ahead of me several years. And I sat in the same seat that she once sat in. And, of course, Dr. Farnstrom was a professor, graduated from Northwestern University in speech. She did some work, I don't know what it was, all of what it was, on that film, which was about an 18-year-old young married lad who was falsely accused of murdering a cop. And it took a newspaper, a crusading newspaper reporter, a real journalist in those days, star James Stewart. And also F. Lee Thompson played his editor at the old Chicago Sun. It's a true story, and I recommend the film highly. E.G. Marshall played the father, not the father, but he was the second marriage of the woman who whose husband, 18-year-old, was falsely accused of murdering a cop. Was kangaroo court trial, and he was sentenced to prison for many years. Later, he got out, and the governor in the state of Illinois gave him a big sum of money because he was falsely in prison. This isn't the only time this has happened. Among the events today, this may be for with all these weather disturbances that we're having. In the year 79 BC, Vesuvius erupted and it buried not only Pompeii, but a town called Herculaneum. Now people are, their excavations discovering all kinds of things that happened in Pompeii, quite a bit of sexual misconduct, to say the least. Another Roman event happened today. In the year 1410, Rome was overrun by the Visigoths. This is the beginning of the downfall of the Roman Empire. 1682, Delaware was granted to William Penn, who Pennsylvania is named after today. Ed Penn was a Quaker. 1814, the British burned Washington, and little Jamie Madison had to flee. But eventually, we lost the war, except on the Great Lakes with Oliver Hazard Perry, who said, "We admit the enemy and they are ours." And, of course, General Andrew Jackson and Jean Lafitte at the Battle of New Orleans, which was fought a week after the peace treaty was signed at Ghent. If you like potato chips, the guy that invented them, George Crumb, invented them in 1853. If you like waffles, the waffle iron was invented in 1869. And those of us who use the video and camcorders and cameras, Thomas Edison in 1891 invented and patented the motion picture camera, which later became Kodak, which is now in bankruptcy. In 1909, the cement was poured for the Panama Canal under the administration of Teddy Roosevelt, but he didn't live to, he wasn't president to see it completed. 1912, the territory of Alaska was set up. We got that from the Russians, of course, and of course, there's a San Francisco connection with Richard Badisco, whose ancestor was in De Badisco, was one of the American signatories for that treaty between the Russians and the Andrew Johnson administration and Secretary of State at that time, William Seward. 1912, federal employees got their rights when the anti-gag law was passed, which gave federal employees the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. In 1932, Amelia Earhart completed the first transcontinental flight across the country. In 1949, NATO was set up, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, as a bulwark against Stalin and his predatory adventures in trying to conquer all of Europe. 1954, while Joe McCarthy was a U.S. senator, the Communist Control Act was passed, and we need this again today because these people went into the closet and came out as so-called progressives. It's like about as progressive as a case of cancer or AIDS. In 1959, Hiram Fong in Hawaii became the first Chinese ethnic to be a U.S. senator. Also, Daniel Inouye, a World War II war veteran and hero, lost his arm. He became the first U.S. representative from Hawaii, and he now and still is the senior U.S. senator. In 1968, France became the fifth thermonuclear power. 1981, this came up again. Mark David Chapman was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of John Lennon, and I think it was yesterday that Chapman applied for parole, but it was not granted. And then, of course, this is relevant to the baseball constituency. In 1989, Pete Rose, a famous baseball player, was hit with a life suspension for his gambling. Of course, now it's drugs, performance-enhancing drugs, and with Barry Bonds, and now we have this other guy with the San Francisco Giants. And then we will discuss next week what our proposal is to the Giants to try to help them redeem refurbish their tarnished image, and what George Christopher, who brought them here to San Francisco, what he would say and what he would do. We are very concerned about what's going on in Afghanistan. It is bleeding this country to death. And Americans still do not understand that region. They think some of them who are into the dog arena think that Afghanistan is just Afghan hounds. Well, there are hardly any of those dogs there. But here's what General Zia said. He was the late president of Pakistan who was his plane blew up. It was believed that he was assassinated. And this was what he said about the Taliban and its relationship in what is known as the subcontinent and Pakistan.
Can we just turn to Afghanistan, which you discussed with Mrs. Thatcher? Is it your view that the fighting is going to continue, or do you think that the Russians and the Afghans, the Afghan army, will control the whole situation fairly soon?
Unfortunately, I can't do as much as I perhaps like to. But Pakistan itself hasn't got much resources, and therefore we can't give any substantial help. Neither do we want at this stage, because Pakistan cannot act as a conduit for any military assistance inside Afghanistan. But Sandy, I take my hat off to those freedom fighters in Afghanistan. Today, they're literally fighting with nothing else but sticks. And the insurgency has been kept alive inside Afghanistan. This has nothing to do with Pakistan or with the bordering areas between Pakistan. It is inside Afghanistan. And it shows the courage and the guts of those people who are literally fighting for their freedom. And I wish them well.
Now, Brigadier General Francis Ingle, the late General Ingle, who was a friend of mine, was the last commander of the Bengal Lancers. He went to Sandhurst, which is the British version of West Point, although it started before our West Point. And he served about 30 years down there in India and in Pakistan and on the northwest frontier. And when I interviewed him when he was the honorary consul for Pakistan here in San Francisco, this is what he said about Afghanistan and the Russians.
I'm interviewing one of my old friends, one of the last great generals of the past, Brigadier Ingalls, the last commanding general of the Bengal Lancers. Welcome, General. How are you?
Oh, no, don't go. I'm fine, thank you very much. Nice to see you again. What are all the leading questions you're going to ask me?
Well, the first question, Brigadier, would be, what effect do you think does the Russian defeat and withdrawal from the subcontinent, what would that have on the current situation? How would that change?
On whose situation?
For Pakistan and India.
Well, I think it's to the advantage of both of these countries that they should remove their physical presence from Afghanistan. As you know, for many hundreds of years, the Russians have wanted to obtain a warm water port down on the Arabian Sea, or the Indian Ocean, as the Indians call it. But the British, of course, resisted that for many generations. And I would say that the situation could only improve as far as Pakistan and India were concerned. It's one less threat to their territorial integrity, And of course, we're all hopeful that Afghanistan will find a government of her own choosing that is satisfactory to the people of Afghanistan, and they begin to put their lives together and repair all the damages that have been done in these 7 or 8 years of war, and that they become successful, and we have a neighbor who is economically sound and basically friendly.
General, the reference you made was the Russians seeking a warm water port. Were you referring to the Crimean War?
Well, that was partly something to do with it, but really what I was thinking of, the British had, I think it was 3 or 4 wars with the Afghans. And the Russians were behind each of them, so they say, or so history says. And it was really to keep Afghanistan under the thumb of British policy that those wars were fought. One or two of them were disasters, in fact.
General, one of the claims that the...
Okay, that was the late General Francis Ingle, who later came up after he retired from the Bengal Lancers. He was the second commander of the Pakistan Military Academy, and he probably knew people like the late General Zia, and of course Brigadier Ingalls. He wrote a book and gave me permission to use parts of it, and we'll continue. We did a very long interview with him, and we will continue with our work on, since I unfortunately didn't get up there when I was out in that part of the world as a correspondent. I've done extensive history and dealt with the Russians and did several interviews with them and had unusual contacts. So among the other, we'll go into the other things today. The origin of the sexual preference in our court systems, this whole business about gay marriage, transgenderism, what's happened is we've had these various pressure groups, political pressure groups, which have set up these so-called bogus nonprofits, and they've infiltrated the court system, and they brought in their crotch politics and their sexual agenda into the courts. When I worked in the government, you were barred from bringing in your political agenda, your political preferences. You couldn't wear buttons, none of that, and you couldn't pass out literature. And it was strictly enforced, but that seems to have changed. There's been a lot of relaxation of the rules about this type of political infiltration of various government agencies and the courts. And we've had such horrible, disgusting situations with the California Supreme Court, where we'll put up the pictures in that, where you had clerks and staff attorneys who were outside protesting their right not to be barred from the quote gay lesbian marriages, these are people who have altered the filing of cases and brought in their own agenda and manipulated filings of cases which involve the quote gay lesbian issues. So this is where that agenda has come from. And it hasn't only happened in the Ninth Circuit and in the state courts, but I understand we have this problem in other circuits and other state courts around the United States. But one of the worst is here in California. We will play that dialogue from Some Like It Hot in another program, probably next week. We'll also have, we're going to... had those interviews that have been promised with people who have worked in the legal field. I'm retired from it. And be an interesting aspect on how to do your own case without a lawyer. And this is a lawyer who will give you this advice, an honest lawyer for a change, because we have a lot of dishonest people in the profession who should have been barred and prosecuted a long time ago. We'll also have someone who was a legal secretary for a firm. It's very controversial and still in litigation, even though it has disbanded. And what really goes on from a legal secretary's perspective, or what has gone on. So we'll have that, and then we'll also have one of our favorites, Mae West. She was quite a wit, and some interesting things that she said. We will play that. We're going to end today with Eric Hopper, who I think is very relevant, especially today, with his view. He's another man who has gone to his reward. Unfortunately, we don't have his type around today. But what he said then, back 15 years ago, is very relevant to today. Here's, it's not part five, it's part four.
But was President Kennedy about as close, you would say, to a charismatic leader as we've
had?
Yeah,
he was, to me, you know, I had no feel for Kennedy at all. Kennedy was a European. All you have to do is tabulate how many times Kennedy crossed the Atlantic and how many times he crossed the Appalachian Mountain, and you know where he belongs. And then tabulate the same thing with John. How many times he crossed the Atlantic and how many times he crossed the Appalachian Mountain.
When you talk to Johnson privately, you realize the core of his memory and thought is all with domestic American things.
Absolutely.
Foreign policy seems a great effort for him.
Well, when you get in the Middle West, there is no other world but America. See? We are so big that really foreign affairs don't count. And what the heck? Really, the only reason we are interested in foreign affairs is that we have to prevent a third world war. This is to me. This has been our foreign policy since the end of the last war.
Yeah.
How to prevent the third world war? We are a learning people, Mr. Severine. You know, the immigrants came to this country, they had to learn a new language, they had to watch the game. We are learning people. We learn. We learn from experience, about the only nation that learns from experience. And we have learned our lessons in 1930. We know how third world wars start and how to prevent them. And the way to prevent a third world war is to pick the potential bullet and get as close to him as possible and breathe down his neck until he settles down. And every one of us knows that if France and Britain had turned Spain and Ethiopia into Vietnam in the 1930s, if they had committed there, all the atrocities we supposedly commit in Vietnam, if they made all the mistakes we supposedly are making in Vietnam, there wouldn't have been a Second World War, there wouldn't have been no Hitler, there wouldn't have been no gas chamber. You do not start a world war when a democracy throws its weight around facing a bullet. World wars are started when the democracies are too unprepared, too cowardly, too reasonable, too frightened, or too
humanitarian, maybe.
Too tired, you know, too humanitarian, you know. I'm not going to tell Johnson what to do because I have faith in Johnson. Johnson will do the right thing. I've lived with Johnson all my life. I know that he'll do the right thing, and he'll figure as the great one of, let me go all the way, he'll figure as the foremost president of the 20th century.
You're saying that Johnson will be the foremost president of the
Absolutely.
Century?
Absolutely. I'm convinced.
He's got to
get He's
got to get out of Vietnam one way or another, doesn't he?
We will find a solution to the Vietnam problem. You know, we've never fought a war like that before.
Yeah.
We have to learn how to fight.
You think we could throw our weight around in the Middle East, for example, without making things worse?
Of course, we'll have to.
Have we not discharged our so-called moral obligation to Israel already many times over? How far does it go?
Well, Mr. Severide, you'll never, never, no country of the Occident will ever discharge its debts to Israel. Don't forget, Mr. Severide, the whole of the Occident was involved in the persecution, the humiliation, and the final annihilation of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children. Not one country, with all the open spaces that there are there in Brazil, in this country, in Australia, not one country threw its gates open to the Jews while escape was still possible. These Jews had to crawl on their knees to beg for visas. Not one country remonstrated with Hitler. Not one country broke diplomatic relations with him. We're all involved in it. And to me, Mr. Severide, I have a premonition, as it goes with Israel, so it will go with all of us. If Israel perishes, the Holocaust will be upon us, and history will cease to make any meaning to me. You know, I wrote my first book in 1948, when the miracle of Israel happened. Imagine, after all these unimaginable suffering and degradation, comes the miracle of 1948, when a few thousand fugitives from Hitler's gas chambers got up on their hind legs and defied 14 million Arabs. I remember You know, I, barely literate, trying to write a book, trying to make sense of the enormity, you know, and the calamities which have befallen us. And this miracle of Israel just put heart into me. I felt that history can have meaning. History can make sense. But Israel must not perish, Mr. Severat. Must not. As far as I'm concerned, that's the end. If Israel perishes, there will be nothing to talk about, nothing to write about, nothing. Nothing will make any meaning anymore. History has to make some meaning.
Mr. Offrey, why do you say this so-called Negro Revolution is a fraud in this country?
You know, the Negro Revolution, if you watched it from the very beginning, it was used as an instrument by the Negro middle class, you know, to fulfill its own desires. The leaders of the Negro Revolution have no faith in the Negro masses, no concern from them. It was used, as I tell you, by a relatively prosperous Negro middle class to attain its end. Imagine a Negro revolution moving, starting to move, and the first thing they worry about is desegregation. Who the hell needs desegregation except the Negro middle class who had a boy who they wanted to put in a special school? In other words, it was cut to the needs of the middle class. And the tragedy of it is that this so-called revolution not only didn't bring about any meaningful transformation of the Negro masses, but didn't give the Negro middle class what it wanted. The Negro middle class is just finding out. You see, this is the whole burden of it. See, the Negro middle class now will have to integrate itself with the Negro masses if the Negro is going to attain anything. Look, Mr. Severi, you ask any longshoreman what a Negro leader should do, and he'll tell you it's the most obvious thing that what a Negro leader should do is to dovetail the Negro's difficulties into opportunities for growth. Let me give you an example. You go to Chicago, you go to New York, you have the Negro slums, right? You have Negro unemployed. Now, what a Negro leader has to do is to train, mass training, of these Negro unemployed into skilled carpenters, masons, plasterers, plumbers, painters. He has to master the art of slum renovation. It's a whole art, it's a whole technique now developed. It's a beautiful technique. And then you organize these Negro workers into a solid black union. You understand? And then you renovate the slums. And you don't worry who owns the slums. You just go ahead and turn it into a garden. And after you have renovated the slums, you challenge the discriminating white unions to open up or get wiped out. And this is the way you get power.
How do the Negroes get the resources to renovate?
Oh, the resources. You don't need much resources, and money is floating around. I bet you, Mr. Severite, any time a Negro leader proposes this, but I propose now, the money will come flying to me from government, from private corporations. And they are just beginning to realize it. I've been saying that for years and years and years, Mr. Severite.
Well, now, what about some of these new young Negro leaders like Stokely Carmichael? They sound
there's nothing. They're all phonies.
But it's race hatred they're preaching.
Yeah, but who's going to listen to them? Maybe a few. They are not going to get anywhere because they have these naive conception of power. They say, power, power, give me power. Nobody can give you power. Power doesn't come in cans. When I hear Carmichael, he always asking, give me the can opener, so I'll open the cans of power and eat them. See? And they're all phonies, these people. They do not realize that it's the long-term projects, things that you go about patiently and quietly that will achieve results. Look, once you have realized that, see, you are not going to waste your energies on hatred. You are not going to waste your energies on anything except building. I have been advocating, you know, to build yourself a community. Let me tell you something that happened. One day I came to Pier 35, I think it was, and there it was, on the wall, a poem. And I don't know whether it's good poetry, I don't know nothing about poetry, but the darn thing stuck into me, and I think this should be the anthem of the Negro. It was called Build Yourself a City, and here's how it went. Build yourself a city, found yourself a state, do not cry for pity, grab and master fate, grab a swamp and drain it, cut the log and plane it, make the hill the valley field, and on the man-made plain, breathe your last complaint, slay your shame, forget your name. Do not cry for pity, build yourself a city. This is what I say, build yourself a city. That everybody, any average American, sees that's what has to be done. You waste your energies on demonstrations, on riots. They do not produce one atom of pride. And now they are beginning to realize it, that the Negro has to do things by himself, that anything he is given will turn into worm over the ashes in his mouth. You know, pride. Do you know the chemistry of pride, Mr. Severide? Pride. This is what the Negro needs.
That's what it's all about, isn't it?
That's it. And you don't get pride by having other people do your work for you or give it. And this is why I say now, the only hope for the Negro are these Negro veterans out of Vietnam. The tremendous performance of the Negroes in Vietnam, you know, has been generating a pride that's radiating across the Pacific and reaching into many Negro households. Vietnam is going to do the Negro what Israel has done for the Jews. See? They are proving themselves there. And if I was a Negro leader, I would pitch a tent on the water edge and grab those Negro veterans as they come back. They are the seed of the future. They are the kind of leaders that the Negro needs. The moment the Negro is proud of being a Negro, he'll cease being worrying about being a Negro. I told you that's a great... I think this is a great country because I can be a human being first and only secondly something else.
And that was the late Eric Hopper, and what he said is very true. And unfortunately, the blacks, we don't use the term Negro anymore, have allowed themselves to be conned and co-opted by these phonies who pretend to help them, who've never done anything for the country, but they've done a lot for their own personal pocketbook. And you know the names I'm talking about. We'll continue with this on Monday at 4 o'clock, and we'll end with what's very relevant today because now we're really playing a big poker game in politics.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey,
Tony, what are you going
to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We got to pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the sign?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush, nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's it about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say, neither one. I never even met him.
I say, when you got a pair of Jack, better.
Politics and poker, politics and poker. Shuffle up the cards and find the joker. Neither game's for children, neither game is up.
Politics or poker, which is more important?
Paratrade.
Well, it's that line is still important today, which is more important. This is Peter Paul Pizzola. We'll be back Monday at 4 p.m. Hope I have my voice back. Good night. And go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site for the latest. We're putting up our Cat and Cane Tales of the City for our eclectic video e-magazine. This is Peter Paul Brazil. Good night.